need of repointing. Across the street, the police and fire stations looked much newer, and I remarked on it as I climbed out. "They built them with state and federal grants a few years ago," Naomi said. "The Kane family donated the land." Kane, as in the fertilizer company? And the maiden name of the boy's mother, C.C. Kane Turnbull. "We started toward the jail. She credible, the mom." "She's a piece of work, that one," my niece replied. "Got a sheet going back 10 years. Real wild child, and definitely the black sheep of the Canes. But on this, she comes across as more than credible. The murder has ravaged her. There's no denying that." "The dad?" "In and out of the picture. Recently, mostly out," Naomi said. "And he's got about as strong an alibi as you can have."
"He was in prison."
"Jail, down in Biloxi, doing 8 weeks for assault."
"So he wasn't a good role model in the boy's life?"
"Nope. That was supposed to be Stefan's job." We arrived at the jail, went inside. A sheriff's deputy looked up from behind a bulletproof window. "Attorney Naomi Cross and Alex Cross to see Stefan Tate, please," my niece said, rummaging in her pocketbook for her ID. Mine was already out. "Not today, I'm afraid," the deputy said. "What does that mean, not today?" Naomi demanded. "It means that from what I was told, your client has been a less than cooperative inmate, downright belligerent, as a matter of fact, so his visitation privileges have been revoked for 48 hours. 48 hours? My niece cried. "We go to trial in 3 days. I have to have access to my client." "Sorry, counselor," she said, "but I don't make the rules. I just follow them."
"Who made the call?" I asked. "Police chief or district attorney?"
"Neither. Judge Varney made that decision."
Chapter 11. We waited 2 hours on the second floor of the Starksville courthouse, stewing on a bench outside the chambers of Judge Erasmus P. Varney before his clerk said he was ready to see us. Judge Varney looked up at us from behind several stacks of legal files and a pair of horn-rimmed reading glasses. His steel-colored hair was brushed back in a low pompadour, and his steel-colored beard was close-cropped. He wore a rep-tie and thin leather suspenders over a starched white shirt, and he studied each of us in turn with sharp, intelligent eyes. "Judge Varney, this is Dr. Alex Cross, my uncle, and Stefan Tate's cousin," Naomi said, trying to control her fury. "He's helping me with the case."
"A real family affair," Varney remarked before setting down his reading glasses and standing to shake my hand firmly. "Nice to meet you, Dr. Cross. Your reputation precedes you. I read a Washington Post story about the terrible ordeal you and your family went through with that maniac Marcus Sunday. Terrible thing. Miracle you all survived."
"It was, sir," I said. "And I thank God for that miracle every day."
"I bet you do,"
Judge Varney said, holding my gaze. Then he turned to Naomi.
"So what can I do for you, counselor?"
"Allow me to see my client, sir."
"I'm afraid I can't do that."
"With all due respect, sir," Naomi said, "we are less than 72 hours from trial. You can't limit my time like this without jeopardizing his right to a vigorous defense." The door opened behind us. I looked over to find 4 people coming in. A burly, 60-ish, fair-skinned man in a blue Starksville Police Department uniform. A lanky guy, also in his 60s, in the khaki uniform of the Stark County Sheriff's Office. A tall, whippet-thin woman in a gray business suit. And Matt Brady, the assistant prosecutor I'd met with Naomi the day before.
"My men have rights too, Judge Varney," said the man in khaki.
"Sheriff Nathan Bean," Naomi whispered.
"And Mr. Tate has infringed upon those rights," said the woman, who turned out to be District Attorney Delilah Strong. "Assaulting 2 jailers is not something we want to be rewarding."
"Since when is due process a reward?" Naomi demanded. "It's a right guaranteed every citizen under the 4th, 5th, and 14th Amendments." The blue-uniformed man, Police Chief Randy Sherman, Naomi informed me, said,
"Your client put 2 deputies in the ER,
so put him in chains," I said. "Put him in solitary. But you're obligated to let him be seen by counsel." "We know who you are, Dr. Cross," said Strong, "but you have no jurisdiction here." "No, I don't," I said. "I came down here as a private citizen to lend a family member a hand.
but from the day I started as a police officer and through all my years with the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit, I've known that you can't deny someone the right to a fair trial. If you push this, you might as well send this case straight to an appeals court. So put him in chains or in a straitjacket and let us see him. Or, as a concerned citizen, I will contact friends of mine at the Bureau who investigate civil rights violations. Sheriff Bean looked ready to blow a fuse and started to sputter, but Varney cut him off.
Do it, he said.
Your Honor, the sheriff said, this sends a...
It sends the right message, the judge said. Though I didn't see it that way at first, Dr. and Ms. Cross are correct. Mr. Tate's right to a fair trial supersedes your right to maintain a safe jail. Restrain him as you see fit, but I want him made available to counsel within the hour.
What that son of a bitch did to that boy, Chief Sherman snarled at me as he left. You ask me, your cousin lost all his damn rights that night.
Chapter 12. The pretty little 4-year-old girl with the golden curls wore a pink princess outfit and knelt on one side of a low table. She picked up a pot. Do you want some tea with your cookie? She sweetly asked the older man sitting cross-legged on the floor across from her.
How could I say no to such a kind offer from such a darling young lady? He replied, smiling.
He knew he looked ridiculous in the crown she'd made him wear, but he was so entranced by the girl that he didn't care. Her skin was the color of fresh cream, and her eyes shone like polished sapphires. He watched her pour the tea into his cup so delicately, it made him want to cry. Sugar? She asked, setting the pot down.
2 lumps, he said.
She dropped 2 cubes in his cup and 1 in her own. Milk?
Not today, Lizzie, he said, reaching for his cup.
Lizzie snatched up a pink wand, reached out, and tapped his hand with it. Wait, I have to make sure there are no evil spirits around. His brow knit, and he drew back his hand. The little girl closed her eyes, smiled, and waved her wand. His heart melted to see her caught up in fantasy, the way only a 4-year-old can be. Lizzie opened her mouth, to deliver a spell, no doubt. But before she could, there was a knock behind him. Irritated at the interruption, the man turned and the crown fell off his head, irritating him further. A muscular, bald, white guy in his 30s stood in the doorway, fighting not to show his amusement.
Can this wait, Meeks? The man asked. Lizzie and I are having tea.
I can see that, boss, but you got a call, Meeks said. It's urgent.
Grandfather, you haven't had your tea and cookie, the little girl protested.
Grandfather will be back as soon as he's done, he said, groaning as he got to his feet.
When will that be?
She demanded, crossing her arms and pouting.
Quick as I can, he promised.
Grandfather walked to Meeks, who was still smirking, and said,
Fill in for me.
The smirk disappeared.
What? Sit down, have some tea, and eat a crumpet with my granddaughter. But you can't wear the crown.
You're kidding, right?
Do I look like I'm kidding?
Acting like he'd rather have put a fish hook through his thumb, Meeks nodded and went to the table, where Lizzie was grinning brightly.
Sit down, Mr. Meeks, she said graciously. Have some tea while you're waiting for Grandfather to come back.
Lizzie's grandfather grinned for all sorts of reasons as he walked down a long hallway and into a richly furnished library office. He ignored the books that filled the shelves. They were all his wife's idea. He hadn't read a tenth of them, but they looked good when guests came by. He picked up a cheap cell phone sitting on the desk, said,
Talk. We have problems, said a man with a deep, hoarse voice. Tell me. She's not listening to reason, he said. She's talking.
Lizzie's grandfather squinted, calculated.
You sure? Yes. How do you want it handled? We'll take care of it.
This surprised him.
Are you sure? There are others we can turn to. Our mess will handle it.
Grandfather accepted the decision, set it aside, said,
Other problems? Naomi Cross threw in a wild card. Brought in her uncle, Alex Cross. Google him. Ex-FBI profiler, now a homicide detective in Washington, D.C. Reputation? Formidable. Grandfather factored that into his thinking. We're clean otherwise? As it stands, yes. Then we don't have a choice. Take care of that situation as you see fit. A moment passed before the man on the other end said, Agreed. Talk to me when it's done. Grandfather hung up and destroyed the phone. Then he left the office and walked back down the hallway, eager for tea with little Lizzie. Part 2. A Fashion Statement. Chapter 13. Palm Beach, Florida. Coco softly sang the tune from West Side Story as he looked in the mirror, aware of the dead woman in a black nightgown hanging by her neck from the chandelier behind him, but much more focused on assessing the new outfit. The tangerine linen skirt hugged his hips sublimely. The matching jockey coat was snug through the shoulders, but workable. The Dries Van Noten high-heeled slingbacks were a bit toe-crunching. The Carolina Herrera silk taffeta blouse was simply remarkable. And the pearl earrings and choker? Just the right air of sophistication. All he needed now was the right do. Coco reached into the box and came up with a lush, shoulder-length, radiant amber wig. It was old. Early 1970s, if he remembered correctly. His mother would have known the exact date, of course, but no matter. Once settled on the two-sided tape, with the last strands of hair combed into place, the wig made Coco look like another person altogether. Mysterious. Sexy. Alluring. Unreachable. I name you Tangerine Dream, Queen of the Garden Party. Coco cooed to the woman staring back at him. A vision of... He turned and looked at the petite dead woman dangling by a drapery cord from the chandelier. Ruth, what would you say? I'm thinking a cross between Julianne Moore in Boogie Nights and Ginger on Gilligan's Island. The haircut, anyway. Am I right? Or am I just a foolish little girl? Coco giggled ever so softly before picking up the Prada shopping bag and other goodies pilfered from Ruth's collection. He started to leave the master suite, then paused to listen. Though he knew that the staff had been given the day off, and that Ruth's husband, Dr. Stanley Abrams, a.k.a. the Boob King of West Palm, was in Zurich attending a medical symposium, it still paid to be careful. Sure of himself now, Coco pushed on down a gallery rich with artwork, although the only piece he stopped to look at was an oil painting of the deceased. There you are, he thought, studying Ruth's beauty. Caught at the moment of your ripeness, my dear. A gift to the universe. Ruth and Stanley's home was enormous and entirely too modern for Coco's taste. But then again, what would you expect from the house that fake tits built? There was a great deal to be said for classic understatement, he believed. As his mother liked to say, when it comes to your art, Coco, and fashion is art, take your motif to the limit, and then back off several degrees. Coco walked through a kitchen big enough to host an episode of Iron Chef and went down a hallway to a steel door. He checked the security system, got a white dust cloth from his bag, and covered his fingers with it before punching in the code. 5 seconds later, he shut the garage door and waited for the electronic voice to tell him the system was armed. The garage had 4 bays. The near one was empty. The second held Ruth's Mercedes, and the third her husband's Maserati. Coco's beloved Aston Martin occupied the 4th bay. But before going to it, he reached into the Mercedes and removed the garage door remote. He backed the Aston out onto a colored concrete area, exited the car, pressed the remote, then wiped it down. When the garage door started to lower, he lobbed it inside.
satisfied when it skittered to a halt a few feet from the Mercedes. Someone intent on suicide would not bother to pick that up, would she? Coco was confident this was the case. He drove out through the security gates of Ruth and Stanley Abrams' massive waterfront estate. Then he realized that the ladies of Palm Beach would already be gathering for cocktails. Maybe he'd go stroll by Ollie's Fashion Cuisine. Would anyone recognize him at Ollie's? He was thrilled at his audacity, his taste for high-stakes games. Let's do it, girlfriend. Let's really shake it up. 10 minutes later, Coco parked the Aston Martin a few blocks away from his target zone. The vintage sports car was a risk, he knew, but he adored it, so it often caused him to act impulsively, demanding his attention when the Lexus would have done just fine. Next time you'll stay home, Coco thought, and put on a pair of retro white and oval framed sunglasses. He set off up the sidewalk, walking the way his mother had taught him, with his shoulders back, his head high, and his hips swaying like a pendulum. The first man he encountered was a jogger in his 50s. Coco could feel his degenerate eyes looking over the tangerine dream. The second man, a Euro in yachting garb, dropped his sunglasses to gape openly. That's it, girl, Coco thought, putting just a little more sway in the booty for the Euro, who'd no doubt turned to watch after the dream. Ahead, the yellow tables outside Ollie's were already filled with a stylish happy hour crowd. He took a breath, thought, mysterious now, sexy, alluring, unobtainable. That's it, Coco. You've got it all. Now flaunt it all. He made his walk even more provocative, swaying his hips back and forth. Coco raised his chin a degree as he passed the restaurant, ignoring the scene, but aware of patrons twisting to look after him. He almost laughed to cause so much mistaken lust and envy.
Chapter 14. Starksville, North Carolina. Though everyone had heard the judge's order loud and clear, it was well into the afternoon before two deputies brought my cousin, wearing leg shackles and handcuffs, locked to a leather belt around his waist, into an interrogation room. Even through the bruises and swelling, I could see Stephen Tate took after our mother's side of the family. He was in his early 30s, tall and heavy-boned like me and like Damon, and we all had the same jawline. I flashed on an image of him as a little boy, running around Nana Mama's yard during one of Aunt Hattie's infrequent trips to Washington. He'd had this infectious laugh, and it seemed like he thought everything was a mystery and an adventure. Alex, Stephen said thickly as he sat down. Glad you came. I nodded, said nothing. Leave his wrists cuffed, but release them from the belt, Naomi said. He may need to use his hands. And turn off all cameras and microphones? Already done on the cameras and mics, an officer said, but there is zero chance we're letting him use his hands. Ignoring her protests, they chained Stefan's legs and the belt to a stout eye bolt in the cement floor and left. Leaning toward us, Stefan said quietly, I'd sweep the room for bugs. I wondered if he was serious or just being melodramatic, but Naomi thought enough of the idea to pull out her iPhone and call up a white noise app that she turned on high. That works, Stephen said. And thank you again, Alex, for coming. You don't know what it means to have you believe that I did not do these things. I don't believe one way or the other, I replied evenly, studying him for signs that he was capable of doing the things he'd been accused of. I'm being framed, he said. Listen carefully, I said. I am your cousin, but I do not represent you. Ultimately, I'm here representing Rashawn Turnbull, and I find out anything that says you killed that boy, I will help the prosecution put you in the chair, or whatever they use here. Lethal injection, Stephen said. I will not lie to you. I did not kill Rashawn. Why'd you assault the guards? Naomi asked. Other way around, counselor. They assaulted me. We'll get back to that, I said. You've read the indictment. And more times than you can count.
Look, I'm telling you, this case, these circumstances, they're manufactured, Alex.
You didn't do any of it?
Some of it, he admitted. But nothing illegal. They've twisted things, taking them totally out of context.
Convince me like you've convinced Naomi, I said, crossing my arms. Start at the beginning.
A very good place to start, Stefan sang, and he tried to smile.
According to the particulars of the indictment, 2 months earlier, Rashawn Turnbull had been found dead in an abandoned limestone quarry, a piece of land undergoing annexation by the city of Starksville. The teenager had been drugged and forcibly sodomized, and his neck had been slashed with a saw. Semen and other evidence found at the scene pegged Stefan Tate, Rashawn's eighth grade gym teacher, as the killer. DNA also linked Stefan to the drugging and rape of 17-year-old Sharon Lawrence, a student at Starksville High School, and she had agreed to testify against him. So I didn't smile when my cousin sang that line from Do Re Mi. Instead, for the next hour and a half, I listened closely to his side of the terrible crimes described in the indictment, interrupting only to clarify verifiable facts, names, and times. Otherwise, I followed the adage that if you really want to learn about someone, you should just shut up and listen. Chapter 15. The day after Rashawn was found, they put the handcuffs on me, Alex, my cousin said at the end of his version of events. Ever since I've been in here, no bail, limited visitation, even with Patty and Naomi. I'm telling you, Alex, I'm being railroaded. I said nothing, still trying to absorb his story in light of the information given in the indictment. He leaned forward. You believe me, don't you? A lot of it has to check out. I promise you, on my mother's Bible, it will. So let's say your version of events is true. Who's behind it? Stefan hesitated and then said, I don't know. I'm hoping you will figure it out. But you've got suspicions. I do, but I'd rather not put them out there. Stefan, your life is on the line here, Naomi said. We need it all. What you don't need is conjecture, Stefan said. That's the word, right? It is, but he gestured at me with his manacled hands. I'd rather have Alex go into this with no preconceived notions. Let the facts I've given him take him where they take him. That way, when he says he believes me, I'll know he's telling the truth. Fair enough, I said, and I checked my watch. It was past 6. Naomi went to the door, knocked twice. The guards came to get Stefan. He said, tell Patty, my mom and my dad that I love them and that I'm innocent. Of course, Naomi said. When will I see you again? He asked us as the guard stood him up and unlocked his chains from the eye bolt on the floor. Tomorrow, my niece replied. When I've got something to talk to you about, I said. Fair enough, my cousin said, and they let him out. Naomi waited until we were outside the jail and moving toward her car before asking, what don't you believe? I believe all of it until proven otherwise, I said. But you seem skeptical in there. I'm skeptical of everything when the rape, torture, and murder of an innocent kid is involved, I said matter-of-factly. That seemed to upset her. Am I wrong to think this way? I asked. No, it's just that Stefan needs people in his corner, Naomi said. I need people in Stefan's corner. I know, but as I said, I am ultimately in Rashawn Turnbull's corner. It's the only way I work. Chapter 16. It was twilight when we parked on Dogwood Road in Burney, only 3 streets east of Loop. We walked down the block to a 2-story duplex in need of attention, paint certainly, but with a lawn that was freshly mowed. The smell of grass was everywhere. One of the porch lights was blinking when a middle-aged, bleached blonde Caucasian woman wearing running shorts and a Charlotte Bobcats t-shirt exited the right door. She gave us the once-over as we came up onto the porch, said, Friend or foe? Friends, Naomi said. I'm Stefan's lawyer. Sydney Fox, she said, shaking Naomi's hand, neighbor and landlord. I introduced myself and explained the family connection to Stefan. Jesus, isn't it awful? Sydney said softly, her face saddening. I love that guy, I really do.
Stefan's got soul and passion, you know. I just pray what they're saying isn't true. Break my heart if it was. And I don't want to think what it would do to Patty. But I'd best be going to take my run. I like it when it's cool like this. Nice meeting you. And anything I can do to help, you just call Sydney. Patty's got the number. The blinking porch light went dead, casting her side in shadows. Shit, Sydney said, and she had to fumble to get her key in the lock before going inside. I guess my run will have to wait a couple of minutes. My niece rang the other bell. The curtain drew back a few moments later. It's me and my Uncle Patty, Naomi said. The door opened. We slipped inside into a simple, tidy living area with a futon for a couch, a trunk for a coffee table, and a flat screen on the wall. The door shut, revealing a fit, attractive blonde white woman in her late 20s. She looked exhausted. She studied me a beat before sticking out her hand. Patty Converse, I've heard a lot about you, Dr. Cross. Eyeing the small diamond engagement ring, I said, and I've heard very little about you other than what Stefan has told me. Her eyebrows shot up and her voice turned yearning. You saw Stefan? They haven't let me see him in days. How is he? Puffy and bruised, but okay, Naomi said. He was attacked, unprovoked, first by inmates and then by guards. Her concern turned to anger. There should be security cameras, tapes. I'll be going after those, Naomi promised. I made a note to myself to find out if the fact that Patty and Stefan were a mixed-race couple had anything to do with the case. Patty offered us coffee, which Naomi declined, and I accepted. We followed her into a galley kitchen, and she made the coffee in a French press while answering a few of my questions. Stefan says you met the first day of school, I said. A new teacher just like him. That's right, she said, scooping coffee from a tin. Love at first sight? Patty blushed. Well, it was for me. You'd have to ask Stefan. It was for him too, Naomi said. Patty got teary, and her hand trembled as she covered her lips. He didn't do this. He loved Rashawn. We both did. I know, my niece said. I asked, how'd you come to take a job in Starksville? Patty said she'd been raised in a small town in Kansas and played softball on scholarship at Oklahoma State. She'd majored in exercise science and minored in education. When she graduated, she decided to move to the Raleigh area, where her older sister had settled, and look for a job. Closest openings were here, she said. They needed two gym teachers to cover high school and middle school. I said, seems fated that you and Stefan would take the jobs. Patty's eyes welled up again, and she whimpered. I love to think so. Chapter 17. I waited until she'd calmed down and then said, tell me about Rashawn Turnbull and Stefan. They were connected right from the start, she said as she poured me coffee. And I admit that it bothered me because our relationship was just blossoming, and Stefan seemed to give as much time to Rashawn and the other students he took an interest in as he did to me. On the third or fourth day of the school year, Patty said, Stefan found Rashawn sitting in the locker room, refusing to change for gym class. The boy was small for his age and withdrawn. Both the black boys and the whites picked on him because his mother was white and a recovering addict, while his father was African-American and a crook. Rashawn felt alone, like he didn't fit in anywhere, she said. Stefan said he'd felt similarly when he was young, you know? Sure, I said. Stefan ever used drugs in your presence? Never. He knew I wouldn't stand for it, but you knew about his past. She nodded. He would never deal drugs. He hates what drugs stole from him and feared what it could steal from kids. Did you ever find drugs in the house? Never. Did Stefan ever just disappear for hours at a time without telling you where he was going? She looked at something in her lap, said, we love each other, but we're not attached at the hip. That doesn't answer the question, I said. I don't know, she said agitated. Yes, sometimes he'd go off, said he had things to do. When Stefan came back, where did he tell you he had gone? She thought about that. Usually for hikes or runs. There's a path that parallels the train tracks that he likes. Too noisy for me. Other times he was staking out places in town where kids gathered. Why would he do that? Patty said that toward the end of last year, there had been a rash of incidents involving heroin and meth at the Starksville High School, including the two overdoses mentioned in the grand jury indictment.
There was real pressure from the principal and school board to identify the source of the drugs, she went on. I don't think any teacher took that more seriously than Stefan. He became obsessed with finding the source.
He says he was out looking for Rashawn the night he was killed.
Patty nodded. Rashawn's mother, Cece, called us around 8, said he wasn't home, and asked if he was here. Naomi said, Stefan said he was upset about many things that night, picked up a bottle for the first time in years, went down by the tracks, drank it, and passed out.
My cousin's fiancé nodded, said,
he said he was frustrated that he wasn't finding the source of the drugs and shocked that Rashawn had told him earlier in the day that he didn't want him as a friend anymore. So he got drunk.
Why didn't Rashawn want to be Stefan's friend anymore? I asked.
Rashawn wouldn't say, and Stefan was...
Somewhere out front I heard a door slam, and then a male shout,
killer-loving bitch! Nigger-loving bitch! I hope you rot in hell!
Two shots from a high-powered rifle ripped through the night. I was up and moving at the first shot, digging out the Glock in my holster. Three more quick shots blew out the living room windows, showering me with glass. As tires squealed, I yanked open the front door and went out in a crouch onto the front porch. The car lights were off, but I could tell it was old. A Beater Impala, white, with horrible mufflers. A figure in a black hood, coat, and gloves hung out the window, aiming a scoped hunting rifle at me. He fired. The sixth bullet hit the cedar shake siding a few feet from me. I tried to get a bead on him, but the car was gone. Breathing hard from the adrenaline, I began to straighten out of my crouch when I saw a blonde figure in running clothes sprawled at the bottom of the porch stairs, blood pouring from a head wound. There was no use even going down to check for a pulse. There was no doubt in my mind that...
Sydney! Patty screamed behind me. No! No!
She began to collapse. I twisted and grabbed her in my arms.
Why?
Patty sobbed into my chest.
Why, Sydney?
I didn't have the heart right then to tell her that it looked to me like a case of mistaken identity. Chapter 18. Within 15 minutes, Dogwood Road was blocked off with traffic cones, and the duplex was surrounded by yellow tape. Crime scene techs were photographing the body of Sydney Fox. A crowd had gathered. An unmarked cruiser pulled up at the perimeter, and Detectives Frost and Carmichael stepped out.
Great, Naomi muttered.
You know them too?
Frost and Carmichael, she said. They led the city's investigation into Rashawn Turnbull's murder.
Good cops, I said, putting aside my first impressions of them.
Reasonably smart, adequately trained, small-town detectives, she said. They say they're by the book, but I suspect they cut corners, play fast and loose with the facts sometimes. And they tend to jump to conclusions.
I'll keep that in mind, I said, and I waited for them to study the corpse.
Frost scratched at his acne-scarred nose, nodded at Naomi.
Counselor?
Detective Frost, Naomi said. This is Alex Cross, my uncle.
We've met, he said without enthusiasm.
He turned to me.
This is my case.
I'm on vacation, I said.
I'm saying that you will have nothing to do with this murder except as a witness, the detective insisted.
Are we good on that right from the get-go?
Your town, your ball game, Detective Frost.
Carmichael said.
What happened?
Naomi, Patty, and I gave our accounts of the evening, including the light going out on the porch and the racial slurs we'd all heard just before the gunfire.
Frost's expression soured, and he asked,
"Is Sydney having an interracial relationship, too?"
Patty frowned, said, "Not that I know of."
"Then they were trying to kill you, and they shot Sydney by mistake," Carmichael said, relieving me of the burden of telling her. "Both of you blondes and all."
Stefan's fiancée took the news hard and looked sick to her stomach.
"Oh, God, I wish I'd never come to this town."
"In the morning... we'll need you at the station to give sworn statements," Frost told us. "In the meantime, you need to leave the premises. We've got more members of the crime scene team on the way."
Patty said, "Can I stay here? In my house?"
The older detective said, "You won't get much sleep." I said,
"Come over to my Aunt Connie's. She's got two extra rooms."
Stefan's fiancé looked too tired to argue. "Let me get a few things."
"You'll put a watch on my aunt's place," I asked the detectives when Patty and Naomi had gone back inside.
Frost said,
I can ask, but that doesn't mean you'll get it.
Budget cuts, Carmichael explained. Which meant Bree and I would have to take shifts watching the cul-de-sac. When Patty had thrown some things in a small bag, we skirted around the body of Sidney Fox. A coroner had a bright light on her, and a tech was taking pictures. It was only then that I realized she'd been hit in the forehead twice. 2 wounds, 3 inches apart. I remembered the pace of the shots, how quick and crisp they... A male voice called out, "Dr. Cross!" I slowed near Naomi's car and saw a big, athletic guy in jeans and a black hoodie climbing from a gray Dodge pickup. He wore a badge on a chain around his neck, and he jogged over to us. "Detective Guy Petalini," he said, smiling and extending his hand. "Stark County Sheriff's Office. An honor to meet you, sir." "You too, Detective Petalini," I said, shaking his hand. "Kind of outside your jurisdiction, aren't you, Guy?" asked Naomi coolly. Petalini sobered, said, "Just paying my respects to your famous uncle, counselor. But now that I'm here, can you tell me what happened?" "A highly skilled rifleman in an old white Impala killed the wrong woman," I said, and then I described what we'd heard yelled just before the shots. The sheriff's detective had gone stern, his full attention focused on me. "Why do you say he's highly skilled?" "He was using a bolt-action rifle, not a semi or a pump, and he managed to put 2 rounds into Ms. Fox's forehead before she hit the ground," I said. "A hunter," Petalini said. "Or military trained," I said. "Know any racists that fit the bill and own a beater Impala?" The detective thought about that before shaking his head. "There are a couple of avowed racists around who drive beat-up old white cars, and a fair number of decent hunters and ex-military types, but no one who's capable of that kind of shooting. I mean, he'd have to have sniper training, wouldn't he?" "Makes sense," I said. "Why are you so interested in this guy?" Naomi said. "Someone tries to kill a material witness in a heinous murder case that went down in my jurisdiction? I'm interested, counselor," Petalini said. "Why would you care if I was shot?" Patty Converse said. "I'm a witness for the defense. You think Stefan's guilty." "I do," Petalini agreed. "I think he's guilty of sin. But that doesn't stop me from being concerned about the safety of everyone else. See, Ms. Converse, I don't want there to be any doubt about this trial. I want the judge and jury to hear both sides fully and then deliberate and condemn your fiancé. Put him in central prison over in Raleigh and get him in line for a lethal injection." Chapter 19. It was past 11 when Naomi pulled up and parked in front of Aunt Connie's bungalow. I climbed out, meaning to head for my old house and my family. But I saw that the lights were all out there. Bree opened the front door to my aunt's place. I'd called Bree within minutes of Sidney Fox's death, but we'd agreed it was better that she stay where she was while I talked to the police. Bree hugged me, kissed me, and said, "Your aunt figured you'd all be starving, so she's been cooking and consoling." "Who's she consoling?" "Ethel Fox," Bree said. "Sidney's mother, she and Connie are friends." "How's the mom taking it?" "Disbelief, devastation, shock. Sidney was her only daughter. Her husband passed 10 years ago, and her son lives out in California. I don't know what she'd do if your aunts weren't here." I put my arm around her shoulder, and we followed Naomi and Patty up into the house. Aunt Connie kept her home spotless, but it was by no means a cold or sterile place. The furniture was warm and cozy, and there were pictures of her and her friends and her children, Pinky and Karen, everywhere. I couldn't find one where my aunt wasn't beaming or hugging someone. Like I said, she never, ever met a stranger. I could see Aunt Connie in the kitchen wearing pink bunny slippers and a matching pink bathrobe and whisking eggs in a steel bowl. The air smelled of bacon, garlic, onions, and coffee. Suddenly, I was ravenous and very tired. I wanted nothing more than to eat, then go next door and sleep. Patty, Naomi, Bree, and I all went into the kitchen. Aunt Hattie was there, too, sitting at the table and holding the hands of an older white woman with wispy gray hair. Dried streaks of tears showed on her cheeks, and she seemed to be staring off into nothingness, unaware of us. "Sidney was the sweetest little thing, Connie," Ethel Fox said in a weak voice. "So pleasing when she was a girl." "I remember," Aunt Connie said, nodding to us. "She was finding herself, I think, after the divorce." The older woman went on,
so happy and looking forward.
You know that's true, Aunt Hattie said. She was doing good, a daughter to be proud of.
Patty swallowed hard and said, I'm so sorry for your loss, Mrs. Fox. Sydney was such a fine, fine person.
The dead woman's mother seemed to break from her trance. She turned her head slowly to look at Stefan's fiancé, who was fighting back tears.
The police said she was shot 'cause of you, Ethel Fox said in a flat, grieving tone.
Patty's hands flew to her mouth and she choked out.
I wish it had been me, I swear to you. I loved your daughter. She was my best friend here, my only friend.
Ethel Fox got up slowly, staring hard at Patty, and for a second I thought she might strike her. Instead, she opened her arms and embraced Stefan's fiancé, who wept on her shoulder.
I know you loved her too, Ethel Fox said, rubbing Patty's back. I know you loved her too. You don't blame me and Stefan?
The old woman pushed away from Patty and shook her head.
Sydney believed he was innocent as much as you do. We talked about it just the other day. She said Stefan didn't have the kind of heart to do something that dark to anyone, much less to a boy he cared so much about.
Aunt Hattie fought not to break down. Aunt Connie wiped her own tears on her forearm, said,
Ethel, you hear me now. Our nephew Alex here is going to find Sydney's killer, just like he's going to find Rashawn's. You mark my words, he's going to make them pay. Isn't that right, Alex?
Every eye in the room was on me. In the short space of time I'd been in Starksville, the town had revealed dimensions more ominous than I remembered. Deep inside, I wondered whether I was up to the task of figuring out who killed the Turnbull boy and now Sydney Fox. But they were all looking at me with such hope that I said, I promise you, someone will pay.
Aunt Connie broke into her toothy grin and then poured the beaten eggs into a black frying pan with a hiss.
Sit down now, I'll finish up.
Sydney was right, Aunt Hattie said. Whoever killed that boy had a dark heart, and my Stefan does not.
I realized she was directing the comment at me. Had Naomi told her what I'd said earlier in the day about owing my allegiance to the victims?
Before I could respond delicately, Ethel Fox said, You ask me, there's only one heart black enough around here to kill a boy like that. You ask me that Marvin Bell's involved somehow.
The name sounded familiar, but I couldn't place it. My aunts evidently could, though.
Hattie got a stricken look and turned her head away. Connie rapped hard on the edge of the skillet with the wooden spoon, glanced at me, saw my confusion, and then looked to Sydney's mother and warned quietly.
Ethel, you know you don't want to be accusing that Marvin Bell of nothing unless you got 50 God-fearing Christians behind you saying they saw it too, in broad daylight and with their own two eyes.
Who's Marvin Bell? Bree asked. My aunt said nothing.
He's slippery, that one, always in the shadows, never showing himself, Ethel Fox said. Then she pointed a bony finger at me.
And you know why your aunts ain't saying nothing to you about him?
My aunts wouldn't look at me. I shook my head.
Marvin Bell, Ethel Fox said. Once upon a time, before he went all proper, he owned your daddy. Your daddy was one of his niggas.
Chapter 20. The word silenced the room, and Bree's face turned hard. So did Patty's and Naomi's. You heard the word used every day on the streets of D.C., one person of color to another, but hearing it from the lips of an old white Southern woman in reference to my dead father, I felt like she'd slapped me across the face with something unspeakable. Her daughter was dead. She was distraught. She didn't mean it. Those were my immediate responses. Then I noticed that my aunts weren't as shocked as the rest of us.
Aunt Hattie, I said.
Aunt Hattie wouldn't look at me, but she said, Ethel didn't mean to shame your father's name or yours, Alex. She's just telling it like it was.
Pained, Aunt Connie said, Back then your father was Marvin Bell's slave. Bell owned him. Your mother, too. They'd do anything he asked.
Cause of the drugs, Ethel Fox said. I suddenly felt so hungry. I was lightheaded. You don't remember Belle coming to your house when you was a boy to bring your mama or papa something? Aunt Connie asked, spooning the eggs onto a plate. Tall, white guy, sharp face, slippery, like Ethel said. Hattie added, all nice one second, meaner than a crazy dog the next. Something blurry, troubling, and long ago flitted through my mind, but I said, no, I don't remember him. What about... Aunt Hattie began and then stopped. Aunt Connie had fetched plates of potato pancakes, crispy maple bacon, and a mound of toast from the warming oven, and she set them and the freshly made scrambled eggs on the table. Naomi and I attacked the food. Stefan's fiancé pushed at her eggs and bacon and worried a piece of toast. I stayed quiet as I ate, but Bree asked all sorts of questions about Marvin Bell, and by the time I set my fork on my plate, stuffed to the gills and feeling a lot less lightheaded and achy, there was a thumbnail biography of him developing slowly in my mind. Some of it fact, but most of it opinion, rumor, conjecture, and supposition. Slippery described Bell perfectly. No one at that table could peg exactly when Marvin Bell took control of my parents' life. They said he'd slid into Starksville like a silent cancer when my mom turned 20. He came bearing heroin and cocaine, and he gave out free samples. He got my mother and a dozen young women just like her strung out and desperate. He hooked my father too, but not just on the drugs. Your father needed money for you boys, Aunt Connie said. Selling and moving for Bell made him that money. And like Ethel was saying, Bell had his hooks into them so hard they were just like his slaves. Ethel Fox said, once Bell even ran your daddy out of your house, tied him with a rope to the back of his car, and dragged him down the street. No one moved to stop him. Flashing on that memory of the boys being dragged on a rope line the day before, I gaped at her, horrified. You don't remember, Alex? Aunt Hattie said softly. You were there. No, I said instantly and unequivocally. I don't remember that. I remember that. The very idea of it made my head start to pound, and I just wanted to go somewhere in the darkness and sleep. Both my aunts and Sidney Fox's mother looked at me in concern. What? I said. I just don't remember it ever getting that bad. Aunt Connie said sadly, Alex, it got so bad, the only way your mom and dad could escape was by dying. Hearing that after so long a day, I hung my head in sorrow. Bree rubbed my back and neck, said, is Bell still a dealer? They argued about whether he was, and Aunt Hattie said that soon after my father died, Bell took his profits and went 20 miles north, where he built a big house on Pleasant Lake. He bought up local businesses and gave every appearance of a guy who'd straightened out his life. I don't believe that for a second, Ethel Fox snapped. You don't change your spots just like that, not when there's easy money to be made. You ask me, he runs the underworld of this town and the towns all around us, maybe even over to Raleigh. I raised my head. He's never been investigated? Oh, I'm sure someone has investigated him, Connie said. But Marvin Bell's never been arrested for anything, far as I know, Hattie said. You see him around Starksville from time to time, and it's like he's looking right through you. What do you mean by that? Bree asked. Hattie shifted in her chair. He makes you uncomfortable just by being near, like he's an instant threat, even if he's smiling at you. So he knows who you are? What you've seen? Bree asked. Oh, I expect he knows, Connie said. He just don't care. In Bell's kingdom, we are nothing. Just like Alex's parents were nothing to him. Any evidence linking Bell to Rashawn Turnbull? Bree said. Naomi shook her head. Patty Converse seemed lost in thought. I asked her, Stefan ever mentioned him? My cousin's fiancée, startled when she realized I was talking to her, said, honest to God, I've never heard of Marvin Bell. Chapter 21. I awoke the next morning to find my daughter, Janie, at the side of my bed, shaking my shoulder. She had on a blue tracksuit and was carrying a workout bag. 6 a.m., she whispered. We have to go.
I nodded blearily and eased out of bed, not wanting to wake Bree. I grabbed some shorts, running shoes, a Georgetown Hoyas t-shirt, and a Johns Hopkins hoodie, and went into the bathroom. I splashed cold water on my face and then dressed, willing myself not to think about the day before and Marvin Bell and what my aunt said he'd done to my parents. Didn't that a mama know? I pushed that question and more aside. For a few hours at least, I wanted to focus on my daughter and her dreams. Nana Mama was already up. "Coffee with chicory," she said, handing me a go-cup and a small soft cooler. "Bananas, water, and her protein shakes are in there. There's some of those poppy seed muffins you like, too." Fattening me up. "Putting some meat on your bones," she said, and she laughed. I laughed, too, said, "I remember that." When I was a teenager, about Janny's age, I'd gotten my height, but weighed about 160 dripping wet. I had dreams of playing college football and basketball. So for 2 years, Nana Mama cooked extra for me, putting some meat on my bones. When I graduated high school, I weighed close to 200.
"Dad,"
Janny whined. "Tell Bree we should be back before 10, I said, and I hurried out of the house with my daughter. Janny was quiet on the ride over to Starksville High School. It didn't surprise me. She's incredibly competitive and intense when it comes to running. Sometimes she's irritable before facing a challenge on the track. Other times, like that morning, she's quiet, deep inside herself. "This coach is supposed to be strong," I said. She nodded. "Duke assistant." I could see the wheels turning in her head. One of Duke University's assistant track coaches ran the AAU team out of Raleigh during the summer. Some of her athletes would no doubt be on the track. Janny was out to impress them all. I pulled into a mostly empty parking lot next to the high school at 6:15 on a Saturday morning. There were only a handful of vehicles there, including two white passenger vans. Beyond them, and a chain-link fence and bleachers, people were jogging, warming up. "You're here to train, right?" I said as Janny unbuckled her seatbelt. She shook her head, smiled, and said, "No, Daddy, I'm here to run." We went through a gate, under the stands, and over to the track. There were 15, maybe 20 athletes there already, some stretching in the cool air, some just starting their warm-up laps. "Janny Cross," a woman wearing shorts, running shoes, and a bright turquoise windbreaker jogged over to us. She carried a clipboard and grinned broadly when she stuck out her hand and said, "Melanie Green." "Pleased to meet you, Coach Green," I said, shaking her hand and sensing her genuine enthusiasm. "The pleasure is all mine, Dr. Cross," the coach said. Then she turned the charm on Janny and said, "And you, young lady, are causing quite the stir." Janny smiled and bowed her head. "You saw the tape of the Invitational?" "Along with every other Division I coach in the country," she said. "And here you are, walking onto my track." "Yes, ma'am," Janny said. "Just for the record, you'll only be a sophomore in the fall." "Yes, ma'am." Coach Green shook her head in disbelief and then handed me the clipboard and said, "I'm going to need you to sign a few forms here, saying we are not in any way, shape, or form considering this a recruitment meeting. This is summer work, and it's all about training. And there's an athletic release form from the Starksville school system at the bottom." I scanned the documents, started signing. "Why don't you take a lap and get warmed up," Coach Green said to Janny. "All business now. We'll be working 200s this morning." "Yes, coach," Janny said, looking serious as she put her bag on one of the low bleachers and ran out onto the track. I signed the last of the documents and handed the clipboard back. "You're here how long?" Coach Green asked. "Unclear," I said. "We're down on a family issue." "Both sorry and glad to hear it," she said. And she shook my hand again before jogging back to several women wearing AAU and Duke warm-up jackets. There were other girls and boys coming in now, younger than the college bunch already out on the track, some roughly Janny's age. Three of them wore Starksville track hoodies. I took a seat in the stands, sipped coffee, and ate poppy seed muffins while Janny went through her prep routine. A slow lap, and then a series of ballistic stretches and drills, increasing in intensity and designed to get her quick twitch muscles firing. The entire time, the other athletes watched her, sizing her up, especially the high school age girls, especially the ones from Starksville. If Janny noticed, she wasn't showing it. She had her game face on big time. Coach Green called in the athletes and divided them into training groups. Janny was put with the local girls, If she cared, she didn't show it. This was all about the clock.
Chapter 22. Green called for 60% effort, and the men went first, running the long left-hand turn of the 200 and then slowing into a trot back around. Green sent the next groups in waves. The seven college girls were serious athletes, strong and fleet. They seemed to dance down the track, barely touching the surface, their legs churning in a quick, powerful cadence. Jannie watched them intently, but showed nothing. When it came time for her group, the high school girls, to run, she went to the outside, letting the others have the favorite lanes. Green said something to her I didn't catch. Jannie nodded and settled in. They ran the staggers with no blocks, just taking off at Green's whistle. Some of the other girls, especially the three from Starksville, were surprisingly gutsy and kept abreast of Jannie through the slowdown. But you could see they didn't have her natural fluidness and stride. The difference was more readily apparent two intervals later when Green called for 80% effort. At the whistle, Jannie took off in a smooth, chopping motion that quickly gave way to the long, explosive lopes of a quarter-miler as she rounded the turn. She led up with 10 yards to go and still beat the high school girls by 3 body lengths.
"Hey," one of the local girls said angrily to Jannie, breathing hard, "80%.
Jannie smiled and said, "That was 70. Her tone was matter of fact, but the girl seemed to think Jannie was being condescending. Her face hardened. She turned and went over to her friends. Coach Green must have heard Jannie say she was giving only 70% because she jogged over and said something to her. Jannie nodded and ran to catch up with the older girls.
"Drop to groups of 4, ladies," Green shouted after them.
The college girls nodded to Jannie when she jogged up, but these were Division I athletes. After that moment of acknowledgement, they put on their game faces.
85-90 now, Green called as the girls moved into the stagger.
At 15.5, my daughter was as tall as or taller than most of the girls, but she didn't have their strength or build. She looked slight next to them. Jannie ran stride for stride with the two strongest girls until they were 150 meters in. Then their conditioning and experience showed. They pulled away from her and crossed the slowdown mark a yard ahead.
90, Green called, and all the girls in that heat, including Jannie, nodded, their chests heaving.
They ran 2 more like that, and Jannie finished 3rd both times. Then Green called for warm down and stretching. The 2 fastest college girls went over and talked to Jannie. The local girls tried to ignore her. Coach Green came to the fence, and I went down to talk to her.
"Has she run in the 200 in competition?" she asked.
"No," I said.
"Quarter mile only."
"Why?"
"Those 2 that beat her, Layla and Nicole, they're pure sprinters. 200's their race. Layla was runner-up at the Atlantic Championships, 12th at NCAA Nationals."
I didn't know what to say.
"I think she wants the 400.
"I know," Green said. "She's raw, but very impressive, Dr. Cross."
"Thank you, I think."
The coach said, "It's a deep compliment. I..." She paused. "Think you might be able to bring her over to Duke next Saturday morning?"
"For?"
"There's a group from Chapel Hill, Duke, and Auburn, all 400 girls. They train there. And I'd like my boss in my other life to see Jannie run."
"I thought this wasn't about recruitment."
"Just a friendly suggestion. I think Jannie will get bored running with the girls up here, and there are more suitable training partners an hour away."
"We'll talk about it," I said. "And it will depend on my family situation."
"Just know the door's open for her," the coach said, and she jogged off. The 3 Starksville girls were coming across the track, and Green high-fived them as she went by, told them, "Tuesday afternoon." The girls shot me hostile glances as they passed, and then went on chattering about something. I watched Jannie kick into her rubber sandals and shoulder her bag. Every move she made was efficient and natural. Even the way she ambled was fluid. Her shoulders, hips, knees, and ankles in perfect loose sync. I realize I'm bragging on my own daughter here, but proud papa aside, I knew enough about athletics to understand that you couldn't teach what Jannie had. It was genetic, a blessing from God, a level of physical awareness so far beyond my comprehension that at that moment, I looked up at the sky and asked for guidance. Jannie came up beside me, shaded her eyes, and scanned the sky too. "What's up there?" I put my arm around her and said,
everything. Chapter 23.
We got home at around 8:20. Ali was up, but still in his pajamas, sitting on the couch and watching a deep-sea fishing show on the Outdoor Channel, one of the few stations that came in well.
"This is cool, Dad," Ali said. "They hook these huge marlin, and they take, like, hours reeling them in so they can be tagged and tracked."
"That is cool," I said, peering at the turquoise waters. "Where is this?"
"The Canary Islands. Where's that?"
"Off Africa, I think." Bree and Nana Mama were in the kitchen making breakfast.
"Why didn't you wake me?" Bree asked as I came in the room. "I wanted to go."
"I'm sorry," I said. "I was trying to let you rest."
"I'll rest when I'm in Jamaica," she said firmly.
I saluted her, said, "Detective Stone?"
"At ease," Bree said, breaking into a soft smile.
"After you eat, can we drive around? Like all around?"
"So I can give you the lay of the land," I said.
"Sure, that makes sense."
"Take me too," Nana Mama said. "I'm going stir crazy sitting in this house when all there is on the television is fishing and hunting shows. And I don't care what Connie Lou says about how much Starksville's changed. When I close my eyes, I see it as it was."
Oddly, I didn't. I realized that I hadn't thought of the bungalow as my childhood home or as my parents' home since that first night in town. The psychologist in me wondered why that was. And what about my aunts insisting I'd witnessed my father being dragged by a rope? Was I blocking it? If yes, why?
"You all right, Alex?" Bree asked, handing me a plate.
"Huh?"
"You're brooding about something," she said.
"Feels like a brooding day," I shrugged, sat down at the table, and began to eat. Naomi came in, said, "Isn't this where we left off?"
"Nothing wrong with having 2 breakfasts in 8 hours, Nana Mama said. "You want anything, dear?"
"I can barely move from last night's cholesterol bomb," Naomi said, and then she looked at me.
"Do you want to see where he was found, Rashawn?"
"Long as we can take in the sights along the way," I said. An hour later, temperatures were climbing into the 80s, and it was growing stickier by the minute. I put the Explorer's AC on Arctic Blast, Bree rode shotgun, and Naomi and Nana Mama were in the back. We drove slowly north, zigzagging through Burney, which was still mostly as I remembered it, a few degrees shy of shabby and inhabited by black folks and a smattering of poor whites. On the east end of the neighborhood, Naomi pointed out a sad duplex, said, "Rashawn lived there. That's C.C. Kane Turnbull's place."
"When did his mom last see him alive?" Bree asked.
"That morning when he went off to school," Naomi said. "He was part of an after-school program at the YMCA, so she didn't get alarmed when he wasn't home by 6. But at 7, CC started calling his cell. He didn't answer. His friends said they hadn't seen him, so CC called Stefan and the police."
"The police look for him?"
Bree asked. "Half-heartedly at best. They told CC he was probably off somewhere with a girl, or smoking pot."
"At 13? Bree asked.
"It happens around here," my niece said. "Even younger." I drove north across the tracks and the Arch Bridge and through the neighborhoods into downtown. We passed a liquor store, and I noticed the name, Bell Beverages. I wondered whether this was one of the supposedly legitimate businesses Marvin Bell had bought with his drug profits. We drove through the center of the city and into wealthier neighborhoods. It wasn't wealthy in the New York or D.C. sense of the word, but there was a definite middle class there, with larger houses than the bungalows and duplexes in Burney, and bigger and better kept yards.
"It was just like this when I was a girl," Nana Mama said. "You had the poor blacks in Burney, and the whites up north here with all the jobs."
"Who's the big employer now?" Bree asked. Naomi pointed through the windshield to a grassy hill surrounded by those middle-class neighborhoods and a vast brick and wrought iron wall. Beyond the wall, a long, sloping lawn had been trimmed like a golf course. In the sun, the lawn seemed to pulse green, and it ran up the hill to the only structure in Starksville